your family has photos of relatives that go back several generations, maybe you've noticed the people in them looked old before their time. Most 35-year-olds could pass for 50 today, and those who made it to 50 often looked positively ancient. Even accounting for them doing more physical labor than folks today, it's pretty astonishing that these relatives who shared some of your genes look so worn out, almost as if aging worked differently in previous centuries. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Not only do years seem to have different effects on people over time, cast a wider net across the animal kingdom and you see certain insects have a life expectancy of just a couple of days, while bowhead whales are known to live 200 years or more. It makes you wonder, is there some biological trick for longevity, and could we copy it to give ourselves more years of good health? Niklas Brandborg is a PhD student of molecular biology at the University of Copenhagen. His book is called Jellyfish Age Backwards: Nature's Secrets to Longevity. Niklas, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
It turns out if we use ourselves as a model of what we know about how aging works, we are missing out on a lot of information, right? So lobsters don't lose strength or fertility as they get old. They never stop growing. How do lobsters die if they don't end up, you know, covered in melted butter on someone's table?
Yeah, so old age for a lobster is definitely nothing like old age for a person. So as you say, they get just like stronger, more fertile, larger with time. And actually in the end, it tends to be the size, if not humans or another predator that kills them. So they can become so big that some of their daily tasks simply become too exhausting for their systems. But the like old age for a lobster is the complete opposite as for a human. So it's basically the older you are, the stronger and the more well-functioning you are.
Wow. Yeah, we don't maybe want to grow forever, but we wouldn't mind gaining strength as we go along. What is this species of jellyfish that seems to be able to literally revert from the adult life stage to the body it had when it was a juvenile?
Yeah, so it's that's like the next step. So you can imagine we could look at animals, like you mentioned before, the bowhead whale that live a lot longer than humans and be jealous. Then we could look at the lobster that doesn't age at all and be more jealous. But then we could look at this jellyfish Tuatopsis and maybe be the most jealous that we can be, because this is an animal that not only doesn't age, it can actually age backwards. Basically, this tiny jellyfish, which is called Tuatopsis, if you stress it in the correct way, it will revert back to its polyp stage, like a butterfly turning into a caterpillar again, or like you and I going back to being a kindergartner again, basically. And then it can grow up anew. You can stress it once more, and it will rejuvenate itself. And then you can just make it go around and around in these rejuvenation cycles, and practically live forever, at least in theory. So no one has found a limit to how often this jellyfish can do this trick.
So that's basically a way of adapting to conditions in its environment at any given time. Is that right?
That's certainly a good theory, that it could be a way to wait out for better times in case that it, you know, finds itself somewhere where perhaps there's not enough food, perhaps the temperature in the water is off or something like that. But the thing is, there's a lot of similar species of jellyfish, and they don't have this trick. So it's a few species. Tuatopsis is the one I talk about. There's also a few others, but most jellyfish, like your average jellyfish, will not be able to do this.
Broadly speaking, size seems to matter for animal longevity. Whales live a lot longer than mice, for example. Why might evolving a large body grant animals a long life?
Well, in theory, the first thing you would, like if we imagine we are totally naive, we might think that, wait, a bigger animal might have a shorter life, because a problem that a lot of animals have with time is cancer. And if we assume any cell can become a cancer cell, well, if you're a big animal, you have a lot more cells. So that should have meant that you have a larger risk of cancer. So that's actually not the case. And that's because larger animals have better cancer defenses. It's a famous example, for instance, with elephants. that has a certain cancer protective gene that we have one copy of, they have 18 copies of the same gene to protect themselves. Most likely the reason this we see this pattern is that if you are a larger animal, you have fewer natural enemies. So you have a lower risk of dying from some random event like predation or maybe even physical injury. And that means it makes more sense for you to take your resources and invest them in upkeep of the body as compared to just, for instance, if you're a mouse, you know that eventually or soon something is going to get you. So instead of investing in the far future, you just put all your resources into reproduction and then just get as many, as much offspring as possible. And then when something eventually gets you, you can say you fulfilled your evolutionary duty.
But there are some exceptions to the rule among small rodents. What makes naked mole rats outliers when it comes to lifespan and absolutely fascinating to biologists?
Yes, so that's a really interesting example, because now we've established this rule that, you know, some of the longest lived animals are stuff like certain whales, elephants, humans, some of the shortest lived mammals are stuff like different kinds of mouse-like creatures. But then it also is a little troubling for someone who studies aging science, because say you want to then study an animal that lives a long life, are you then going to try to keep a whale in your laboratory? That's going to be a little hard. Same with elephants and so on. So really, if you want a laboratory-friendly animal, you need a small animal. Well, then you could see, are there any small animals that just live way longer than we would expect from their size? And the naked mole rat is just the best example we can find here. So it's the size of a mouse, so approximately 30, maybe 35 grams. And a mouse in a laboratory will live maybe 2 or 3 years, but a naked mole rat will live past 35.
Wow.
And has these really, really weird adaptations. For instance, most laboratory mice, between 70 and 80% of laboratory mice die with cancer. So not necessarily of cancer, but they have a really high likelihood of getting cancer when they get old. In naked mole rats, even though we've studied tens of thousands, I think there's been found 6 tumors in total. And even if scientists try to induce cancer in these animals, like give them some kind of chemical or try to irradiate them to induce cancer, nothing basically happens. So they're just extremely, extremely cancer resistant.
Many people want a silver bullet, right? We want one thing we can do or change so that we don't get old and infirm. But many people have been intrigued by the discovery of so-called blue zones in different parts of the world. These places where people on average are much more likely to live to be at least 100 than anywhere else in the world. Why, though, Nicholas, is it challenging to pinpoint exactly why folks in Okinawa and parts of Italy and Greece and even California thrive into very old age?
Yeah, so this concept about blue zones, as you say, is a concept referring to these specific parts of the world where you have a very high likelihood of living past 100. Now, the problem with this kind of research is that maybe the oldest kind of fraud ever is to lie about your age. So it's you have to validate these things a lot, because if you don't validate them, a lot of people will try to claim that they're 150 years old and whatnot. And so the problem is that in some parts of the world, especially if you're in a very, very like rural area, maybe record keeping is not perfect. So on the one hand, we have some scientists that, of course, have done an amazing job and done tons of interviews in these blue zones and tried to figure out, like, it looks like they live longer. Why could it be? But other scientists are then saying, well, we don't actually know if they even live longer, because these areas could be areas that would be prone to maybe not have perfect record keeping. For instance, even in a very well-organized country like Japan, they had 10 years ago this survey where they tried to get in touch with everyone who said they were more than 100 years old. And there was just more hundreds of thousands of these people that they couldn't get into contact with. Then when they tried to visit the oldest man in Tokyo, they found a skeleton basically, and he'd been dead for 30 years. It was basically because no one had reported that he was dead, and in other cases because people might be able to keep getting benefits, so they don't tell that their mom or their grandmom is dead, because then they keep getting a pension from the state. But then if you look at the longevity statistics, it looks like these people are living a long time. So it's really a really tricky thing, actually. It's a simple question, where do people live the longest? But it turns out to be quite tricky to actually find out.
We all hope we've inherited good genes for longevity, but of course, by the time we're born, it's too late to do anything about the DNA we have. What tells you that genes may, in some ways, be overrated as a determinant of how long we might live?
Yes. So in the last 2 decades, maybe a little more, we have learned a lot about genetics. And the general rule seems to be that a lot of traits have a genetic component, how we look, how our personality is, different like factors about our bodies. So usually people have kind of thought that, the general rule has been it's more genetic than we thought initially. Like even stuff we didn't think was genetic turns out to be genetic. But this is the one exception actually when it comes to aging, because the better studies, the larger studies we do, genetics seem to matter less and less and less. So these studies could, for instance, be studies where you look at identical twins. They have exactly the same DNA. So genetically, they're like a clone of each other. And then you compare how long they live. Sometimes even you can find pairs of identical twins that have been separated at birth and adopted by two different families. And if you look at these studies, you usually see that they are very similar in a lot of ways, these twins, personality-wise, looks-wise, of course, height and so on, even though they have never met each other. They have quite like, they seem like very similar people, but their longevity is usually not very similar. They usually have quite the difference in when they die or how long they live. There's also been other studies where, for instance, Google has collaborated with something called Ancestry.com, which is this huge website with lots of pedigrees. And then they've tried to see what is the correlation within families for like lifespan. Do people from the same families all tend to live long or live short lives? Just like we know, for instance, that people from tall families tend to cluster together. Like if there's two tall parents, they might have tall kids as well. That's very likely. But when it comes to lifespan, they don't really see this correlation. It seemed to be very, very low. And basically, the whole point of this, the thing this is actually good news, is just that that means if it's not the genes, it must be the environment, meaning that we actually have a lot that we can do ourselves to determine how long we're going to live.
You write about this fascinating study that shows married couples, heterosexual couples, have more similar lifespans than opposite sex siblings. I mean, presumably the siblings would have a lot more in common genetically. Why would spouses take on similar lifespan possibilities?
In couples, there will be this common culture created, maybe one where you exercise a lot, maybe one where you don't exercise, maybe one where you eat healthy, or maybe one where you don't eat healthy. So when the longevity within a couple is more correlated than between siblings, it basically just underlines again that what you really want to be looking at is not the genetic gifts, it is the environment.
Nicholas, there are some genes that do seem to have an outsized influence on our lifespan, including the ones that protect us from infections and the ones that affect metabolism and growth. Why would those, throughout the course of a lifetime, have a positive or negative effect at the end of our lifespan?
Well, first of all, we previously talked about this fact that you can see in old photos that people, for instance, 100 years ago, they just look a lot older than they are, at least from a modern perspective. So a 50-year-old person back then looks way older than a 50-year-old person today. And one of the reasons we've found is that people back then had more chronic infections, or just more infectious in general. And if there's one thing that ages you, it is what's called inflammation, at least excessive inflammation, which comes about when the immune system is activated. So we can just see that the fact that we have a lot, like our hygiene is a lot better now. We have antibiotics so we can kill off bacterial infections. We get vaccinated and have eradicated a lot of these really, really nasty viral infections that used to really cripple people. So that just means that we have less overall inflammation. And of course, there will also be individual differences in the immune system that then could have that then can play a role in how we react, and for that reason be tied to longevity. And then the one about growth is actually interesting because we previously talked about the correlation between size and longevity, right? Whales mm-hmm. live longer than a mouse. Big animals tend to live long. But then actually, if you look within each species, this rule is flipped on its head. So if you look within species, it's the small ones that live longer than the large ones. So for instance, as many dog lovers know, small dogs tend to live longer than large dogs. Ponies also live longer than horses. The longest lived mouse ever is something called an Ames dwarf mouse, which is like half the size of a normal mouse. And then, for instance, if you go look at the longevity records, first of all, everyone is female, so everyone that lives a long life that is on the list of longest lives is generally female, and women also tend to be smaller than men. But we also see that these people are very small. So the number one, Shen Kelmin, she was about, I think in American units, five foot one, something like that. Below her on the list are stuff like 4'11", 5'2", and stuff like that. So in general, all the longest lived people are really, really short. Even if you go to the men's side, they're also, they're a little larger as men tend to be a little taller than women, but they are generally like not that tall. So 5'4", 5'5", 5'6", and that stuff. So that's probably why we see these correlations that within a species such as humans, it's probably better to have less growth signaling if you want to live a long life. So that's why we can see it in the genetics.
This is interesting because when you're looking at longevity, I guess at some point with a lot of other conditions, evolution would take care of that. But longevity doesn't really play itself out until long after people are of reproductive age. Is that part of what's going on here?
It's at least a good theory for what is going on. We actually don't have a perfect theory for why we are even age in the first place, but the best theory is something like what you say, that basically we just don't have in nature, you are probably going to die from something at some point anyways. Even if we could make you like biologically immortal, you might get a nasty infection, or you might get eaten by a predator or killed by a rival or so something. So at least at some point for the body, it doesn't make sense to revert resources to perfect upkeep. It makes more sense to focus on the now and on reproducing itself now. Because if you'd make perfect upkeep, well, then you're going to lose it all when you die from something anyways. But we actually don't have all the evidence. So there's a lot of different theories of why we age. And it is quite puzzling, actually, that it's 2023. And this is like one of the biggest mysteries in all of biology. And we haven't solved it.
So let's talk more about that. You explained there are a couple of hypotheses about how aging works to degrade human bodies. The first, I think, is that over time, we just sort of lose the ability to repair damage to our cells and that builds up.
Yeah, but that's definitely part of the story. The big question is, why does this happen in the first place? Because, for instance, we see some of the same damage accumulate in a mouse as in a human with age. So then you might say, oh, this is just a law of nature. This is just what's going to happen. The thing is, though, that this stuff happens in a mouse at like age 2 or 3. In a person, it might not happen until age 80, 90, or even 100. Then if you go to a bowhead whale, it doesn't happen until 200. And if you go to a Greenland shark, it doesn't happen until age 400. So it's kind of a mystery if all of this damage is the same, right? But then why does it progress so much faster in some animals than others? And that must be because we have better defenses against this kind of damage. So then we could only hope to learn for instance, the bowhead whale, why it does so much better than us, and maybe we can then make new medicine based on what we learn from a long-lived species like that.
So the other hypothesis of how this might work is something called programmed aging. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's kind of the controversial new theory, because there is a theory that aging is somehow programmed, so that it's not, you know, damage accumulating, that is something that we do to ourselves, that the body kind of shuts itself down for some reason. Now, the reason this theory is not accepted widely is because it doesn't really fit into a lot of what we know about evolution. It doesn't fit mathematically. It doesn't really make a lot of sense and fit into everything else we know about biology. But there is some evidence for this theory, so that's why scientists don't just dismiss it like completely, because sometimes in biology there can be some weird phenomenon that we haven't learned about yet that could explain why this is. But the thing is that it's like on every theoretical grounds it just doesn't work at all, but then there is some experimental proof that there could be such a thing as programmed aging.
We've all been conditioned to think about stress of all kinds as a purely negative thing for our well-being, but there is a certain kind of stress that works differently that we need. Can you explain hormesis to us?
Yes. Hormesis is a general concept for basically strength through adversity for a biological organism. So if, for instance, lots of people, when they want to live a long life, maybe they compare themselves to some mechanical object like a car or a watch or something. Like if you want to have your car last as long as possible, you just never use it at all. Just put it in your garage and just don't turn it on. And, you know, it will stay functional for a lot longer than if you drive it all the time and use it, and, you know, then it will get a little bit of damage here and there, and in the end stop working. But that's just not how biological organisms work at all. So if you just completely remove every stressor in your life, it's not going to make you healthier. Actually, quite the opposite, it's going to make you less healthy. The best example in people is really exercise. So a lot of people know it's very healthy to exercise. In fact, right now it's one of the best things you can do if you want to live a long life. But then a lot of people just don't know why it is so healthy. They might think that it's because while you're out for a run, that's where you actually do all this benefit to yourself. But if we think about what actually happens while you're out running, then your heart rate is elevated, your blood pressure is elevated, you damage your muscles, you damage your bones from moving all your weight, you stress your lungs from taking in a lot of air. So while you're at it, you're actually making yourself weaker. You're actually damaging yourself. But then the clever thing about biological organisms is that we're dynamic. So we can actually repair the damage that happens to us. And when the body sees all the damage you've done to it in exercise, it says, I need to be stronger. So it starts all these processes involved in bodily upkeep, in strengthening as well. So the next time you go for a run, your heart is stronger, your lungs are stronger, your muscles and bones are stronger. So in the end, the stressful events ends up making you stronger than you were before. And that's not just something we know from exercise. That seems to be a very general phenomenon in a lot of different organisms. There's even these crazy examples, for instance, where scientists have taken different kinds of worms and then they fed them a weed killer in a low dose. And if you do that, I mean, if you give them a high dose, they die from poisoning. But if you give them a low dose, they actually live longer than normal, than the worms that don't get exposed to this weed killer. There's also been studies in mice where they've taken mice and put them under radioactive radiation. Again, if you do it a lot, they get cancer and die. But if you do it at a low dose, they actually end up living longer than the mice that are not irradiated. So, of course, just to make it perfectly clear, I'm not advising anyone to try weed killers or
Or radiation.
radiation or anything like that for a long life, but it's just to say that there are these general stress response mechanisms that it seems to be beneficial to trigger. So you can do it with exercise. You can also, it seems, do it with what's called heat stress. So in laboratory animals, again, if you expose them to short periods of high heat, for instance, laboratory worms will live longer than if they are in a normal temperature all the time. And there's also human data on that, actually, because in Finland, close to, relatively close to where I'm from in Denmark, they really, really love going to the sauna. It's like their national, cultural thing, export to the whole world. And there's a lot of studies on people going to the sauna in Finland, and they seem to have lower risks of dementia, lower risk of cardiovascular diseases, and also a lower risk of dying early. So that could again be because this is, of course, a stressful event to the body. I know it feels nice, but to the body, it's not very pleasant to be exposed to a very high heat. So it's again something that is stressful in the short term, but then turns on protective mechanisms and ends up making you stronger. So this is like a general framework. Again, it doesn't mean that every stress factor will make you healthier. Say if I go bang my head against the wall, I don't get any smarter by that, for instance. And of course, shouldn't take any weird poisonous thing because you think it's gonna make you live longer. But there are certain kinds of stressors like exercise, like heat, that can be a good idea to include in your day because the stress will actually eventually make you stronger.
How could certain foods be a source of hormesis for us?
So there's a general consensus, I think, among everyone, both scientists and also most normal people, that we know stuff like vegetables are healthy. That's if doesn't mean you have to be a vegetarian to live a long life. In fact, we can see that that doesn't really make you live longer. As long as you're healthy in other ways, you can eat meat and live as long as someone who's vegetarian. But definitely, it's a good idea to have a lot of vegetables in your diet, whether there's meat in there or not. And there's, of course, different reasons. There's lots of nutrients in vegetables. They're very filling. They have fiber. There's lots of good stuff. But one interesting thing about vegetables is that just like everything else, plants don't want to get eaten. So just like us. And that actually means that these plants kind of fight back against the creatures that try to eat them. So you can imagine, for instance, as a human, let's say we go back in time and we're walking on the savannah. If something pops up that wants to eat us, for instance, a lion, we have two options. We can run or we can fight and try to use one of those to save our lives. But if you are a plant and someone, say a person, comes by and wants to eat you, you can't really run anywhere, and it's also really hard to fight back. But of course, as I said, plants don't want to be eaten either. So basically, what they have developed, a lot of them, is a way of defending themselves using chemicals. So they basically do chemical warfare against the animals that try to eat them. So there's an incredible amount of plants that are poisonous in one way or the other. We don't think about that much because we get our plants now from the supermarket where we eat domesticated versions and only the safe ones. But if you go out into a forest and you actually want to survive there, it's really, really, really hard to not accidentally make yourself sick from eating some plant that's actually poisonous. And that actually means that a lot of the stuff that we eat, for instance, the predecessors of some of the stuff we eat, for instance, wild almonds contain what's called cyanide, so one of the most toxic substances we know. The stuff the Nazis used during World War II to commit suicide, basically. So really, something that you don't eat more than once if you get a hold of some wild almonds. So that's a plant that is straight up deadly. Then there's also plants that are a little less harsh. For instance, the reason it hurts your mouth when you take a bite of a chili, that's of course because the chili plant has tried to develop a defense that will make you not eat it by putting you in pain. So it works on other animals, doesn't really work on some humans. But if you ever see, for instance, a dog eat a chili, you see that this stuff works. So it's just a general pattern that we see a lot of plants have these compounds that are somewhat poisonous or unpleasant, but then that could actually be why they're healthy. So if you see some of these compounds when they're taking up in the body, a lot of them are going to, for instance, the liver, just like stuff like alcohol would, to get detoxified. But that could be why they're actually healthy, because they deliver a low dose of a stressor, and that then makes the body turn on its defenses.
Nicholas, if you account for the fact that regular blood donors might start out healthier than the population at large, if you control for that, why else might it be the case that blood donors tend to live longer than people who don't donate blood?
Well, that's a very, very interesting case. So it's there's been studies, for instance, here in Denmark, where I'm from, where we have really good registries of this stuff. And yeah, they can see that people who donate blood live longer. And even if you look within blood donors, the more times people donate, the more of this benefit they seem to get. And there is some research ongoing, both in like cell cultures and also especially in rodents, where it seems that there could be something in the blood that has an influence on aging. There's been these little not so appetizing experiments where scientists have tried to basically sew two mice together. And if you do that with a young mouse and an old mouse, first of all, they start sharing the blood. So now they have a single pool of blood. But then you can see that the old mouse get rejuvenated from this, and the young mice basically starts to age faster. So it seems that when they get when they start sharing some of that blood, then they get pulled towards each other in like physical function. You can also do the same thing if you just inject the blood. So it seems that there is something about the blood that has some kind of role in aging, and people don't really know what it is. Could be that young blood has some beneficial aspect, like some molecules that that help you stay physically well. But it could also be, and which I think is more likely, that old blood has some stuff that you'd rather get rid of. So if you're a blood donor, you get rid of blood occasionally, 4 times a year, at least here in Denmark. I don't know if other countries have other rules, but then you lose blood. And at least we know if you take old mice, you don't actually need to inject young blood to rejuvenate them. You can actually just take their own blood and just replace it with saline. That's enough to get this this reaction. So the human equivalent is human blood donors who also lose a little blood now and then. And it seems there is something about the blood, but we don't know more than this really at this point.
We know too little iron in our blood can contribute to anemia and other health problems. Why would too much iron also be bad for us?
Yeah, so that's that could be one reason that removing a little blood could be healthy for some people, at least mainly men, in that we tend to get higher blood levels of iron, higher bodily levels of iron, basically, as we age, especially men, because women tend to lose a little blood every month through menstruation. But for modern men, there's really no source of blood loss. And we, even though it seems a little weird, the human body actually doesn't have a mechanism to dispose of iron. The reason you can lose iron from losing blood is that the reason your blood is red in the first place is because of a protein called hemoglobin, which has an iron molecule, or has several iron molecules in it. So when you lose your red blood cells by, for instance, blood donation, then you need to make new ones. So you need to take some iron from your body stores, and that, of course, depletes them a little bit. So if iron is implicated in aging, or at least in aging in some people, or in the risk of certain diseases, well, then if you lose some blood every now and then you will deplete your iron stores, and you will have a way to get rid of excess iron. So of course, we know also that too little iron is not good, but it's important to remember in biology that it's pretty complex. It's not just about, you know, taking this value and making it as high as possible, or taking this value and making it as low as possible. There's like an optimal level. And it seems like a lot of people, at least a lot of men, tend to get to go too high when they get older at this point.
What are telomeres and what role do they play in the longevity of our cells?
Telomeres are these really interesting structures in our DNA. They sit at the end of our chromosomes. You can think of it kind of like the aglets or the little tip that sits in a shoelace, where you have all your DNA in these long threads, chromosomes, and they actually have the problem that shoelaces have as well, that the ends can get damaged or unravel. So we have these structures in the end that basically just consist of DNA that doesn't really code for anything. So it would be very bad if we started losing our actual genes, the genes that our cells need to function or to make the proteins that they need to survive. But if we just lose a little bit or damage a little bit of these structures, we basically don't lose anything. So you can think of it as these structures that just sit at the end to protect the ends of the chromosomes.
Is there anything we could do to elongate our telomeres as they start to shorten over time?
Yes, so that's the interesting thing about them, that in most cells, when we get born, in most cells, we start out with quite long telomeres, and then every time a cell divides, they tend to shorten a little bit. So that could you would see it as kind of a biological clock, because as the cell divides, they get shorter and shorter telomeres, and actually at the end, when the telomeres have shortened enough for it to be dangerous for the cell, so that some of the genes are jeopardized or could become damaged, then the cell actually becomes what's called senescent, so it stopped dividing and it's basically aged in the cellular way of aging. So we could say it's like an aged or old cell that is ready to basically die. So then some people have thought, well, what if we could elongate these structures again? We know when we are before we get born, and most of our cells naturally elongates the telomeres. They have this enzyme that does it, so you can think of it as a little molecular machine that can go and elongate these structures. So there's been a lot of excitement about what if we could elongate these things, because at least in cells, if you do this in a cell, you make the cell go from like an old state back to something that resembles a young state again. So it's horribly more complex than that, but it's one of the things that has, there used to be at least a lot of excitement about. The problem is that you will probably also increase your cancer risk if you elongate your telomeres. So it will help you get rid of several age-related kind of conditions, but it will probably increase your risk of cancer. So it's not the best of trade-offs at the moment.
Nicholas, why might calorie restriction be useful for extending lifespans?
Calorie restriction is basically the most reliable way to prolong the life of laboratory animals. So we know of a lot of drugs that can prolong the life of, say, a mouse or a fruit fly or a worm, but the best way, the most reliable way, is calorie restriction. Basically, you take an animal, you give it all the vitamins and minerals it needs, but then you just give it too few calories. And again, you might think this could be some sort of hormesis, so some sort of stressor that then makes you stronger. Because at least what we can see is if you calorie restrict the mouse a little bit, then it lives a little bit longer. If you calorie restrict it even more, then it lives even longer. And actually, some of the mice that live the longest are just basically on the edge of starvation. So again, this is probably not something you would want to try on yourself. There is actually a group over in the US called Calorie Restriction Society. So that's a group of people that actually practice this on themselves. And if you check these people, they have really perfect blood pressures and perfect cholesterol levels and really good immune function and all that stuff. So they seem to be very healthy. But even though this is something that works in animals and perhaps in humans, I don't really think a lot of us are gonna try. So we usually say that these people might not live forever, but it's certainly gonna feel like they're gonna live forever.
It turns out to be a real challenge to study what works and what doesn't in terms of extending human longevity, precisely because we live a long time. Are there any ways, animals are a good model, but they're not perfect. Are there any ways we can speed up this kind of research?
Yeah, so that's a big, big, big problem. Basically, in all of biomedical research in general as well, it takes so long to get the answers. So for instance, even if we don't talk about aging research and say you think you found something that could help patients not get dementia, well, what are you going to do? Maybe take some patients that are 80 years old and maybe you follow them for 5 years, or maybe you follow them for 7 years or something like that. And then you see, did it work or not? And only once you have that data can you then, you know, change a little thing, because most likely it didn't work, and then you can try again and you have to wait 5 or 7 years more. And it's the same thing with longevity. If you think you have a compound that extends lifespan, if you test it in a mouse, in max a few years you have your answer, and you can also start giving it to old mice and maybe you have your answer in 1 year. But if you do that in humans, like say we have this new wonder drug and we want to test it, then if we enroll people who are 70 years old, even if we wait 10 years in our trial, there's not so many people who have died from aging yet. So, I mean, we have to have a lot of people to even be able to tell, did the drug work or not? So it is one of the big reasons why biomedical research is kind of slow compared to, say, IT. Or different in general, just software development, which we usually see as technology, or is the main type of technology that people see fast progress in. But one thing we could do is to see if we could find some surrogate marker that we could test and then use that to describe how old you are.
The final ingredient in longevity that we really haven't talked at all about is social relationships. How could these make a difference in our physical health and our longevity?
It's a very important aspect of health that not enough people speak about, the mental aspect of health. So, for instance, we can see that on the list of the largest risk factors for an early death, number one is being a smoker, and number two is actually loneliness. And only after that comes stuff like obesity or lack of exercise and so on. So the reason loneliness is so detrimental is probably that humans are very, very social animals. So one of our like deepest needs is to have close relations to other people. And if you remove that, that's really something that will make us not thrive at all. So we know that mental health also impacts us, our physical health. For instance, also if you lose a spouse, you have a lot larger risk of dying in the next year compared to someone with a similar like health status as yourself who doesn't lose their spouse. And it just seems that in general, if we don't thrive mentally, then we just don't thrive physically either. So more anecdotally speaking, if you listen to interviews with a lot of these people that have lived a long life, it's a lot of the times people that are very happy, very grateful, very laid back as well, tend to be social. Doesn't mean you have to be an extrovert to live a long life. It's not about like the quantity of social relationships, it's more about the quality. That's also what anthropologists always tell us when they come back from studying some of these societies, some of these villages where people live a long life, is that they don't have all that much in common. But one thing they do have in common is always these really, really tight social relations in the community where people really engage with each other and tend to be very involved in their community in general. So there's definitely an important thing to remember when you try to call it optimize your health is to also remember that if it does make you feel good, you're not getting all the benefit that you could get. So it's an important aspect to keep in mind as well.
Niklas Brandborg is a PhD student of molecular biology at the University of Copenhagen and author of Jellyfish Age Backwards, Nature's Secrets to Longevity. Niklas, this is so interesting. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts, or you can listen to the podcast at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.